Welcome to the Standard Deviations Podcast, presented by Orion Advisor Solutions and hosted by Dr. Daniel Crosby, Orion's Chief Behavioral Officer and New York Times best-selling author. Each week, Dr. Crosby interviews a fascinating new guest on a range of compelling topics, from literature to psychology to financial wellness. To learn more about Dr. Crosby's behavioral finance work at Orion, visit www.orion.com.
Hello and welcome to the Standard Deviations Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Daniel Crosby. Today, I am joined by none other than Morgan Housel. Morgan is a partner at the Collaborative Fund. He is the author of the best-selling, 2 million-selling, The Psychology of Money. But he's best known for writing the foreword to my book, The Laws of Wealth, and for being the most downloaded episode of Standard Deviations ever. Welcome.
Is that true? Well, That's true. Thank you, Daniel. I'm happy to be here. That was years ago that we did that. I remember doing it with you.
That was years ago. That was before your book even came out. We actually used the framework of your book, your eventual book, as the template for that conversation.
Is that true? I don't remember that. I remember recording it with you. I remember where I was, but I don't remember the format of it. But that's interesting. That's great.
That is true. You are the most downloaded episode ever. It's really not even close. And brought the thunder from India, like just the downloads from India when you appeared on the show were incredible. So shout out to the Indian listeners and thanks for being here again.
Shout out to the Indian listeners. Almost half of my book sales are from India, almost half.
Yeah,
very disproportionate to what you might think. And same with blog traffic and whatnot. I think I know it's similar for you, kind of other people in this space, a disproportionate share of readers and book sales come from India.
No, it's true. I've been I always keep a close eye. I don't actually monitor my podcast stats all that much, but about every week we get about 140, 142 countries represented, which is so cool to me. But when you came on, India was just bright. So thanks. Shout out to India. Thank you for being here. So Absolutely. Three or four years ago or whenever it was, we went through your book cover to cover before the book even existed. So we're not going to do that again. Instead, we're going to take listener questions. We got questions from people on Twitter and Twitter responded in a big way. And so we're going to take questions from folks on Twitter, which could go in any number of directions, as you know, but we're going to start with a question from me because it's my show. And I wanted to start with, which of the ideas from The Psychology of Money do you find most useful in your own life? And if you had to change the book, if you were to re-release the book today, what would you change about it or omit from the book?
Well, I'll start with the first one. What's been most relevant to me? I think the idea of just trying to be reasonable instead of rational, that the best that we can do for it is to aim to be reasonable. Because if you are holding yourself to a standard of every decision you make has to be purely, coldly, analytically rational, I just think that's just not a realistic way of how humans work. And maybe that's been the most appealing to me personally, because I'm a little quirky. My wife is a little quirky. Our financial goals and situation is a little bit different than other people's. So to be able to release yourself and take the weight off of your shoulders and be like, hey, I do things that I cannot explain on a spreadsheet that I know are analytically wrong. You could say they are irrational, but they work for us. It fits our personality. They might not fit your personality, but they fit mine. And by the way, that I'm sure that goes vice versa. Everyone is a little bit different here. And I think a lot of people find problems with their money and their investments when they are looking for the quote unquote right answer, the one right answer that is just the right thing to do. And they view investing like it's physics. And in physics, there is one right answer for everybody. It's just a formula. And I just think there's so much evidence that money is not like that. And it's almost like it's closer to the taste in music or your taste in a spouse or something. People who are equally intelligent and equally informed come to very different conclusions over what's the best music. And people understand that. Some people understand, oh, you like country music, you like hip hop. You're not right or wrong. It's just people have different tastes. They have different outlooks and whatnot. And I think money is like that as well. So I think of all the things that I've been studying for 15 plus years, that's probably been the most helpful at like, oh, I'm going to use this in my daily life of like, I don't need to explain why I'm doing this. And look, being reasonable does not mean that you're being insane. like being reasonable means that most of the things you can do, fall into the standard financial and economic frameworks that exists out there, but trying to push everything down to the furthest decimal point of rational, like this is the perfectly rational investing allocation, that I kind of abandon. And I just kind of say, this is what works for me and helps me sleep at night. So that's why I do it.
So I want to come in here. We have a framework for having conversations at Orion. It's this 5-part framework. And the first 3 parts are empathize, normalize. And then the 3rd one is to talk about purpose. So empathy, we get that. I think that's widely understood to be a good thing. But the normalization process is, I think, where a lot of us fall down, because I think especially professionals have been taught there's a right way and there's a wrong way. It's good and bad. It's optimal and suboptimal. And for me, it's all about, first of all, nobody's money story is irrational when you know the whole story. Now, it may not be adaptive. It may not be what they ought to be doing, but you can at least comprehend it. And no one gets out of bed in the morning like seeking to be crazy and make poor decisions. So when you can normalize that decision, and then you evaluate it against their purpose, right? Is it serving them? When I was a shrink, one of my favorite questions was just, how is that working for you? Because people would come to me doing all manner of things that I would not do. And I had to learn to check myself, because my initial impulse is like, whoa, that's weird. And then you go, well, wait a minute. I'm cut from a very specific cloth. My way is not the right way. How is that serving you? Is it serving your purpose? So reasonable over rational.
That's really important. My brother-in-law, who's a social worker, has this quote that I love. Being a social worker, he's worked with a lot of broken families, broken children who are going through a lot of problems in their life. And he has this quote where he said, all behavior makes sense with enough information. If you have enough information about what people have experienced, what they've been through in life, what their outlook on life is, their behavior starts to make a lot of sense. That doesn't mean their behavior is right. That doesn't mean they should be doing it. That doesn't mean it's not going to cause consequences that they will later regret. But all behavior makes sense with enough information.
Totally agree with that sentiment. And I would add, I think there's a corollary there that I found in my time as a therapist, that all people are likable with enough context and enough story too. I found that, I mean, I'll be straight up, I don't do this work anymore, so I can say this. There was a subset of my clientele who I just hated seeing, right? I mean, you'd see their name on your calendar and you're just like, oh my gosh, like, you know, here we go. And then you get to know their story. You know where they're coming from. These sort of jarring, obnoxious, grating behaviors, you go, oh, like you learned this in a specific place and time and context, and that served you well for a time, and it's not serving you well here. So not only does it make sense, I think it humanizes people and makes you connect a lot better with them too, when you can take time to listen to that story.
I mean, the most extreme example of that, of course, is the number of like mass murderers who were abused as children and had the most wretched childhoods you can imagine is so disproportionate to the rest of the population, of course, not excusing anything that they do, but like we are all prisoners to our past. We are all so heavily shaped by our past, and everyone wants to think that they can think open-mindedly and that they can ration their way through the world and change their minds and whatnot. But we are so, and you can to an extent, but we are so heavily shaped by our past. Years ago, this is maybe 10 years ago now, I did an interview with Daniel Kahneman, who was a psychologist who won the Nobel Prize in economics. And he was talking about how much of a pessimist he is and how he's so pessimistic on just like the outlook of humanity. And we started talking about why that was. And he mentioned at one point that he grew up in a Jewish family in Nazi-occupied France. And he saw from an early age what evil looked like. And it stuck with him, of course, for the rest of his life. He was a young child living in Nazi-occupied France, watching his friends and neighbors being hauled off in trains. And that was his view of the world as a child. Of course, that stuck with him in a way that I can read about and try to put myself in his shoes, but never in a million years will I have the scar tissue, the emotional scar tissue that someone who experienced that would. So those are all extreme examples, but all of us are victims of that in one way or another.
Yeah, perfect example and a call for empathy and kindness and patience and a lack of judgment. Is there anything in the book that you would do differently? And goodness knows there's going to be second and third and fourth editions of the book. So will you make any changes in subsequent editions of the book?
I don't know. So I finished writing the book in December of 2019. So like just before COVID began. And COVID is obviously, in terms of just how people interpret risk and deal with risk and forecast the future, COVID was the biggest like magnifying glass of our lives so far. And so that's not in the book because I finished writing it just before that began. There's things in the book that talks about risk is what you don't see coming and whatnot, which is exactly what COVID was. As I was writing those words, there was a virus percolating, you know, very slowly across the world that was going to change all of our lives. So I don't know if I would remove anything yet, but I would probably add in a lot of examples from the last 2 years of how people deal with risk and uncertainty. Mm-hmm. One thing I would say though, with a lot of confidence, even though if it's not yet, I would say with nearly 100% confidence that in 20 years, there will be parts of the book that I would not only change, but disagree with. You know, one of the chapters in the book is about how much people change and how the theory in psychology called the end of history illusion, which is that people are very cognizant of how much they've changed in the past, but they are so ignorant of how much they're going to change in the future. So if you look at yourself, Daniel, today and compare yourself to when you were 19, totally different person, completely different person. But if you were to forecast, okay, who are you going to be at age 57? You are probably, and I'm just picking on you, everyone's like this. You are probably very ignorant of how much you're going to change between now and age 57. All of us are like that. So I know that there are views of the world and of money that I firmly believed when I wrote this book that I will probably look back on and say, I didn't really quite understand X, Y, and Z yet. And also, you know, I wrote the book through the lens of someone in his mid-30s with two young kids. That's the lens through which I wrote this book. When I am retired and my kids are off of college, I'll view the world very differently. So I don't know what it's going to be yet, but I would say with so much certainty that things will change. One really like technical example of this, I've always thought it's really interesting, is the book, The Intelligent Investor by Benjamin Graham. The investing Bible, every self-respecting investor has read it and is familiar with it. There were, I think, five different editions of that book over the course of, I think, 30 years, something like that. And in every edition, Ben Graham basically threw out all of the formulas from the previous edition and made new formulas. And Jason Zweig, who annotated the book, was asked about this years later. And Jason's like, of course, that's what he did. All the old formulas that used to work stopped working because the market basically like exploited all the opportunity. Everyone found out about the formula. So you had to come up with new ones that worked. And so the idea that the world changes and you need to update your views and your strategies accordingly is so obvious, but it's so difficult for people to do. So I hope, and I say hope because I really don't know if it's true, but I really hope that as I change my mind about things that are in the book, I'm honest with myself rather than digging in my heels about it.
No, that's the fact that you're willing to speak about it in such candid terms, I think is a symbol of that willingness to change. So Mona Shaw asks an interesting question. Mona asks, what did he expect readers to take away from the book and contrast that with the feedback he has received from readers, and what kind of action are people taking based on his writing? Have there been any surprises about what you thought would hit versus what has hit?
Well, the answer to the first question, what I expect people to get out of it, the answer is really nothing. I've always had this idea for all of my writing on blogs and books and whatnot that I call it selfish writing. I am writing for an audience of one, and that is me. And that is, it's intentionally selfish. The reason I do that is because you will always, 10 times out of 10, do your best writing if you yourself are interested in it. Rather than saying, what does somebody else want to read? How can I write, you know, through their lens? I only write things that I personally think are neat. And I take a leap of faith that if I think they're neat, other people will as well. So what was I thinking that people would get out of this? Nothing. I wrote these stories because I thought they were cool. I was not thinking about anybody else. I like to think of myself as an empathetic person in the rest of my life. But when I write, I am very selfish. And I've always tried to do that way. It's so much more fun and you do better work if you never think about the audience when you're writing. So that's the answer to the first part, is I expected nothing. To the question of what are some like feedback of that I thought was really interesting that I did not anticipate. The last chapter of the book, it's near the end at least, is a book called Confessions, where I didn't include any numbers, but I laid out, here is exactly how my wife and I manage our money. And you know, there's no income numbers, but then there's no net worth numbers, but it's here's exactly how we spend our money, our philosophies, how we invest, laid it all out there. And there was a lot of negative pushback from that in ways that I did not expect. The most was, I've always been open about this. I'm a pretty passive investor. the huge majority of our investments are low cost index funds. And I go into why we do that, but I can't tell you how many people said, I liked the book until I read that you're an index fund investor and now I can't take you seriously anymore. And I think there is such a knee-jerk reaction to the idea that if you invest in index funds, you are admitting that you have no idea what you're doing. To me, it's almost the opposite. It's almost the exact opposite. If you invest in index funds, like you've reached the sage point of investing, of realizing how hard it is and how much the odds are stacked against you. But that feedback, it was so frequent that I almost wish I hadn't included. Like I still like not quite to that level. I still just wanted to be transparent and honest, but I can't tell you how many, literally hundreds of people were like, oh, the book was good, but this guy's an index fund investor. And I feel scammed that he didn't even tell me that until the end. Cause now the rest of the book is not credible. That was really fascinating to me. And it's just like an indication of how people view a signaling of skill and intelligence and competence in investing.
So it's fascinating too, that maybe folks glossed over and missed the points where you talked about how investing is idiosyncratic and what works for you may not work for me and reasonable versus rational and all that. It's fascinating because I got almost the opposite feedback. So, you know, both of my best read books have pieces in there where they talk about sort of exploiting behavioral inefficiencies in markets. And I get dinged by so many bogleheads who are like, the first 2/3 of the book I loved. But then when you even suggested that markets were a little bit inefficient and that there was anything you could do besides index, you lost me. And so we're so decamped, I feel like, into these two camps. It's sort of a shame that we can't be a little bit more tolerant of other ideas here.
Absolutely. I mean, I feel like a lot of people's religious or their investing beliefs take on a religious fervor of like, they are so ingrained in them that the idea of doing anything different is sacrilegious. And they take it as an insult. They take it as a slight. If you are a day trader and I'm an indexer, it's almost like they view me or you or anyone else as like a threat to their intelligence. And right. That's where I get to this idea of like, no, there are a thousand ways to skin a cat and a million different ways to invest, however you want to frame this. And there are a lot of people who I really respect, genuinely respect, who invest so differently than I do. Right. And they probably invest in a way that would make it so that I could not sleep at night. And if they invested the way I do, they wouldn't be able to look themselves in the mirror in the morning. Like everyone is so different. And that's obvious to me, but for some people, they view it as if you invest differently than me, it's because you are dumb. Or no, that's it. That's how they view it. They view like people who do things different than me clearly lack the intelligence that they have, I think is generally the view of it.
Well, and the psychologist in me says that if your views are that fragile, right? I mean, if your opinion is that easily shattered, then maybe you don't believe it that deeply after all.
It's like what is like the opposite of love is not hate. It's
indifference.
Indifference. Thank you. And that's what's true. Like if you really didn't care, if you are really felt great about your investing beliefs, you would not care how other people invest. But exactly. if you have some doubts about them, then you view competing views or alternate views as a threat to what you're thinking.
No, absolutely. So we started off talking about your broad international audience, and you posted a picture the other day that gave me a massive inferiority complex. My books have been translated into 12 different languages, and you had a stack of like 30. So you have this great international audience. And the question here is one that I think is interesting because of my work, again, as a clinician. I spent one semester as a graduate student in Hawaii. And the clients that I saw in Hawaii, it was at a university that had an enormous international student population. So the clients I saw were primarily from Asia and the Pacific Islands, but very different than sort of the upper middle class white clientele that I had historically worked with. And I found that a lot of my old bag of tricks just simply did not work. And that some of the things that I would have recommended to one group of people were in some cases really culturally insensitive to another group of people, or just didn't sort of gel with how they see the world. So Joe Wiggins asks, how applicable does Morgan feel the lessons from the psychology of money are across cultures?
It's a great question. It's again, back to the selfish writing, something that I did not spend 1 second thinking about when I was writing it. And never once did I say, how is this going to be viewed through the eyes of a Japanese reader or a German reader? Never once did I think that. I won't give you any indications of what these are, but there have been in a couple of the international editions, the publisher from that country said, we need to remove X, Y, and Z because it might be offensive to the audience. In every one of those cases, I was utterly shocked and surprised what they removed. I'm not going to say what it was, but in every one of those cases, and not my shock was not how could you possibly think that? My shock was I never in a million years would have thought that would have been offensive. Everybody lives in their own bubble, including me. And you and I are white, college-educated, millennial Americans. That's what we are. It's not our fault. It's nothing. It's just who we are. And we view the world through that lens. Both you and I do, Daniel. And I think everyone is like that. And everyone kind of lives in their own bubble. So I'm sure to the degree that I do not understand a German audience, a Portuguese audience, a Brazilian audience, whatever it might be, those audience can't understand my view from the seat that I sit in as an American. Everyone's a little bit ignorant to that. And I think everyone is probably shocked at what the differences are because everyone's definition of quote unquote normal is what they grew up with and what they do. In other words, that's the beauty of international travel is realizing how much of a bubble that you live in. And so that's what's so enlightening and interesting about international travel. But if you write a book that people are hoping to get information and wisdom out of, and it is so antithetical to your local culture, I can see why that would be disheartening to some people. Some of the reviews I've gotten too from the international audience was good book, but it's written solely for an American audience or solely through the lens of an American thinker. And I wanted to say like, well, of course, I'm an American. Like, what did you think? Of course, that's what it is. I'm an American. If you wrote the book in India, you would write it through the lens of an Indian audience. Like everyone does that. So I don't know if there's varying feedback of like one country took away this and another country took away that. Maybe one thing that does come across that I was definitely aware of before this is that the American economic experience for the last two or three generations has been very good. If you look at, or let's say more than that, the last 100 years has been very good. And there are a lot of countries, even Western countries that, you know, if your grandparents grew up in Germany in the 1940s, very different economic experience. If you grew up in Russia during most of the last 80 years, very, very different economic experience than you had if you grew up in America or the United Kingdom or Australia or something like that. So it's easy for an American to say, invest in the stock market and you will make a lot of money over the next 50 years because that has been our experience. If you are from Italy or Austria or Germany or Poland, name a dozen Western nations, you or your grandparents might look at that and shake their head and say, this oblivious, spoiled, you know, person who can think these views when my experience is so different. So it's definitely true. I think that's a fault that I have just based off of the experience that I've had and you have had given where and when we were born. I think one kind of counter that I have to that is like, is it possible that America falls into an economic trap that is similar, that equals complete economic devastation? The stock market goes to zero, the currency goes to zero. Yes, of course it's possible. And you have to think it's possible because it's happened elsewhere. So of course it's possible. I just don't think if you're looking at like the probabilistic odds of what you should do with your money, you should necessarily take that into account as you are investing your money for the long term. Because if the stock market goes to zero, your worries in life are not going to be, how am I going to fund my retirement? Your worries are going to be, how can I eat today? How can I eat tomorrow? Like it's just a very different set of worries. So I don't know if it's, even if you admit that that is a possibility, I don't know if you should actually change how you manage your money. So those have been like the takeaways I've had from international audiences, which have been interesting. I would say too, by the way, just given my view of selfish writing and view, just like the acknowledgement that everyone lives in a bubble that they probably can't escape. Even after those learnings, I don't know if I'm going to change how I write for the next book and the next blog post. Even if you learn about that and you become more cognizant of it, it's just, of course I write through the lens of an American. I am an American and there's nothing I can do to change that.
Yeah. Just owning it, having an awareness of it. You know, I've been asked when giving international speeches, I was asked in one instance, I won't name the countries involved, but in one case, I had research done that was research that was done by researchers in country A, And the country B where I was speaking was not friendly with country A. And they made me remove the slide because they hated country A so much. And I was like, really? And yeah. they just wouldn't even let me mention this other country that someone had put forth some meaningful research from there. So it's sort of impossible to anticipate every problem. So I don't know. It's a fascinating thing. It's been the most gratifying process. Part of the writing process for me is seeing my work get picked up other places, getting to travel around, and my family also. Anytime I get a foreign rights deal, we get the food of that country that week. And that is the best part. That's the amazing. Best part of all. Yeah.
That's a great way to do it. The other experience I've had, this was many years ago before the book came out, but I did a talk in South Africa. And I think I don't know if I actually explicitly thought this, but I think my gut intuition was that the US stock market has been the best stock market in the world for the last 100 years. I don't know if I actually thought those words, but my gut was that was probably the case. And this group that I was speaking with in South Africa, they said, Morgan, do you know that the South African stock market has significantly outperformed the US stock market with less volatility for 100 years? And they told me that. And I didn't say this, but in my head, I'm like, there's no way that's true. There's no way that's true. They sent me the data. It is 100% true. Like one full percentage point of outperformance with less volatility for 100 years. That blew my mind and made me just, again, realize like how naive and how much of a bubble I live in of thinking a very American-centric view of like, oh, of course we have the best stock market. And it's not even remotely true.
Yeah, it's moments like that where I think you have to check yourself and it gives you a broader outlook on and maybe some more tentativeness and humility. I got shouted down in 2013, so I was quite new to this whole game. In 2013, I was giving a speech and I was citing some of Robert Shiller's research on real estate and effectively the behavioral reasons why people think that their home is a better investment than it is. And a gentleman from Australia was like, homes are the best investment you could ever make. Homes only go up, and sort of showed me the data. And I'm like, well, that has been true where you're from, right? You know, yeah. that has absolutely been the case where you're from. It's not been the case here. So it's, I think, a lesson in humility for all of us and maybe leaves us more open-minded to potential future paths for our market and other markets. Just about anything can happen.
Yep.
Love this question from Dan Haylett. Dan asks, what's the best conversation you've ever had about money and with whom?
I mean, by far and away, by an order of magnitude, it's with my parents and my wife. And with my parents early on, actually, you know, what's interesting about the conversation with my parents is that a lot of them were not explicit verbal conversations, but I learned so much through osmosis by just watching my parents manage money. My parents are very good at managing money with no financial experience or education, or you know, they don't have any financial education. But I've often thought, and I make these numbers up, that like 10% of people don't need any help with their money. They don't need a financial advisor. They were born into the world intuitively understanding how this works. And even if they can't even verbalize, I don't think my parents could formally verbalize exactly why they do the things that they do and why they invest, but they did everything right. And my parents have been dollar cost averaging into Vanguard index funds for 40 years and have never sold anything. And they have no financial training. That just made sense to them. They're just like, that seems like the right thing to do. So I think I picked up a lot from them. And hey, by the way, that's how I invest my money today too. So of course, like, where did I get that from? That's where I got it from. I watched them do it. And so I'm a product of my past as well. So that was a really, really important, even if there were very few, if any, like, I don't think I ever sat my parents down and said, hey, can you teach me about money? Like, no, actually, I'm sure that never happened. But it was just slid bit by bit along the way. And then my wife and I have been together since we were since we're 20 years old, something like that. So we kind of started our adult lives together and been together ever since. So my adult views of money have been completely, you know, step by step with her together. And I think she, if I go back to myself when I was in my early 20s, I was like a lot of young men in their 20s. I was like, I want to be the billionaire with a Ferrari and a private jet and a Bentley and diamond Rolex. And like, that's what I wanted. That's what I wanted to be. And I think she had a big, powerful impact on me, even if it wasn't explicit and verbal, to be like, no, like, actually, I think you just want to be a nice dad and a good husband and a good friend. And that's all that's going to make you happy. And if you are that, you will be happy in the smaller house. And if you are not that, you will be miserable with the Ferrari. I think she was really good at teaching me that and moving me away from the naive young man of just thinking everything was about material flashiness and turning me into like, no, actually what makes a difference in life is like how good of a person you are. And that was really important for me too. So those are the two things, even if they were not individual conversations that I can necessarily pick out, had the biggest influence on me by an order of magnitude.
Well, you know, this is going to actually lead me to fast forward to my next question. This question comes from Aravind. I'm going to mess up Aravind's last name, Sitham Parapillai. But Aravind asks, knowing what you know, what do you teach your kids about money? And I'm going to be honest, man, this is just selfish because I feel like I'm doing it all wrong. You've got two kids. I've got three kids. I've been completely inconsistent with my kids with money. Sometimes allowance, sometimes no, you know, it's just, I haven't figured it out. So let's talk to the bestseller. How do you teach your kids about money?
I don't know if we figured out either because our kids are younger than yours. My kids are 3 and 6 years old. So they are particularly, our three-year-old is just not at the age where money is even a thing. And our six-year-old gets it because now he wants things and he needs money from us to do those. But we have also been very inconsistent with allowances and like there's a joke that like being a parent is just one long bribe. You're just constantly bribing your kids into good behavior. And that's, we've struggled with that too. Like to what extent do we stop saying, hey, if you behave well at this thing we're going to, we will buy you X, Y, and Z. And in the moment, it's like a drug for the parents. Cause like, you know, it's going to work. You know, as soon as you say, hey, if you behave when we go do this thing, I'll buy you this toy. It works. The kids are like so receptive to it, but where's the boundary between that and just raising a spoiled little brat? That's what's really difficult to do. Any parent that has some sort of disposable income, you know, I think it is so ingrained in your parental cells to be like, I want to spoil my children. I want to use my hard work and resources to give my kids a good life. That is such a knee-jerk reaction, but it's also so clear, abundantly clear instantly, how easy it is to turn your kid into a spoiled brat. And how easy it is for a kid that if you buy them too many toys, how quickly they go from being thankful for the toy to expecting the toy, and how quickly they go from expecting the toy to being angry that you didn't buy them another toy. That happens in 2 seconds. Mm. So I don't know if we figured out a role for that. When you said that you were, because your kids are older than mine, and when you said that you've been inconsistent, that I almost think has been, I think that's the right way to do it, particularly as you go between kids, because I'm the youngest of three. I have an older brother, older sister. We are completely different people. Raised in the same house by the same parents, share the same genetics, could not be more different. And kind of our outlooks on life, we all have great relationships, love and respect each other, but we went very different ways. And I'm sure that'll be the same for my kids and your kids. That, you know, maybe my daughter will grow up to be a kindergarten teacher. Maybe she will grow up to be a partner at Goldman Sachs. And the financial lessons that I want to impart on her are going to vary based off of whether she's one or the other, not by that much, but it's really hard for me to teach life lessons to somebody when I have no clue who they're going to be 10 years from now. That's a really difficult thing to do. Maybe that's just my excuse for not having a strategy yet, but it's very difficult. And maybe the difficulty is the most important part, that, you know, it's difficult enough to come up with a financial strategy that's going to make myself happy. And I know myself better than anybody. You know yourself better than anybody. To try to come up with financial lessons for someone where the stakes are so high, this is your children's life. Nothing matters more to you as a parent. But frankly, like, it's hard enough to do that for yourself when you understand yourself 100%, to do that to someone who you don't know another person, what's going on inside and what's going on inside their heads today. And you have no clue what's going to be going on inside their head 10 years from now. So what do you do there? I think going back to what my parents did, rather than sitting a kid down and giving them a lecture, I think the best that you can do is just lead by example and hope that they pick it up along the way. A lot of that is because kids, particularly as they become teens, are so inclined to rebel and almost go do the opposite of what you tell them to. So if I sit my kids down when they're 14 and say, this is how much you should save, this is how you should invest, this is what you do, I know that it's going to go do the opposite, just out of natural rebellion against the parents. But if I just do that and kind of make them aware of what we're doing, but I'd not say this is what you should do, maybe that's the best that my wife and I can do, is just try to lead by example. And so that's about all that we've thought about it so far. It's definitely a hole that we have not figured out how to fill yet.
Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, I think we've done a couple of things well. We've gotten our kids involved in some philanthropic decision making, which has been really rewarding. It's like, you know, hey, we've got some money to give away. Let's think about, you know, you've got to go create a PowerPoint for me or a little presentation for me, even a, you know, an 8-year-old, a 6-year-old. About who gets this. It's usually animals. It's usually the World Wildlife Federation, right? So it's the things that they value, but that's fine. And you know, that's been really valuable to them. And I think a source of richness for them. Where I struggle, I think, is reacting against my own money story. I mean, just growing up, my dad is a financial advisor, and I was born the day he got his job. So those first years of a financial advisor's life are tough. And then I have a brother who's 12 years younger than me, who grew up financially in a very different household than I did. And so I remember wearing the, you know, the bargain basement secondhand cleats in baseball and being embarrassed. So when my son is, you know, going out for baseball, I'm like, bro, you're going to look like Fernando Tatis Jr. Like, you know, I mean, you're going to have the Mike Trout cleats and the sunnies and the chain. And I mean, like, whatever you need, like, you're going to be dripped out on the baseball field. And I'm like, oh, this is some kind of weird reaction to childhood, you know, childhood want in some sad way. So I think like any parents, we've had successes, we've had failures. I think I've done a good job of teaching them about the fundamentals of the market. But, you know, there's other times my kids and I like shoes, and, you know, it's like I'll buy an expensive pair of shoes and they'll go, how much did these cost? And I'll say, you know, whatever, not $180. And they'll go, oh, that's not bad. And I'm like, no, that's very bad. Like, you know, like that is bad. That's a lot of money. And you need to understand that that's a lot of money. So yeah. I think for folks with disposable income, it's hard to get perspective in a world where we are so rich by global standards. And it's hard to know how to do that.
And here's what's so complicated about this, to put a twist on this. I think I'm stealing this quote from Jim O'Shaughnessy, but he says, you know, his goal as a parent was to raise good adults. He didn't want to raise good kids. He wanted to raise, you know, his children to become good adults. That was the ultimate goal of parenting. And let's say your son today is dripped out on the field. Mm-hmm. What if when he is a father, 20, 30 years from now, he cannot afford to drip out his own kids on the field? Does he feel like a failure? I think about this a lot when I'm like trying to figure out our material life. Let's say my wife and I decided to live a grand material life. We go out and buy the Porsche. We go out and buy the big house. We go out and buy the fancy clothes. And that's the life we live. And we feel like we're being great parents by giving our kids all those luxuries. And then let's say my son wants to become a kindergarten teacher and he's making 40 grand a year. And because that's what the respectable profession that he chose, he can only afford to drive a Honda Civic and live in an apartment and wear used clothes. Does he feel like a failure by comparison because it is a lower lifestyle than he grew up in? And therefore, would I be doing him injustice as a parent by spoiling him as a kid in a way that set the bar too high for him when he's an adult? That's a thing that we struggle a fair amount with as well.
Yeah, it's interesting. One of the things that I feel like I didn't learn from my parents, I learned a lot of great money lessons from my parents. My dad is, again, still an advisor. And so I felt like I got a great sort of education around investing and saving and being prudent with money. But I just didn't know how much my parents made. And so when I exited school and was getting job offers with a PhD for $40,000, $45,000, I was like, oh, like, not that we lived a lavish life or anything, but I'm like, I think whatever you grew up with is sort of your homeostatic level. Like whatever you grew up with is normal. And I'm like, oh, these jobs are not going to give me a quote unquote normal life. So one of the things that I'm trying to do with, we'll see how it goes, is helping my kids understand like, look, this is how we do. This is what it takes to live like we live, which is not crazy or anything, but this is what it takes. And if you want to be a kindergarten teacher, God bless you. Like that's an incredible, honorable line of work, but you will live differently than our family lives today. And that's fine, but like, be ready to make those trade-offs.
The thing that I struggle with is like, I think what every kid wants is to live a little bit better than their parents. I think that's just like the generational growth. And therefore, the question I struggle with is, do I as a parent have an obligation to keep the expectations low to give them the highest odds of exceeding the life that they grew up in. That's a thing I struggle with.
Yeah, we'll air all our dirty laundry here. Last thing I'll say about this is, I look at my wife and I don't have consensus on this. I'm like, look, our kids should just do whatever they want. You know, if they want to be a photographer, a teacher, you know, all these things that don't sort of on paper make great money, they should do those things. Because when I wanted to be a psychologist, you know, when I wanted to get an undergrad degree in psychology, my parents never said, oh, like, you know, what are you going to do with this, or rolled their eyes. And because they didn't, and because I was able to pursue what I truly loved, I've had a career that's been rewarding in every sense of the word in ways that it never would have been if they had made me do something with a more clear path to immediate sort of employment. Like if I had been made to be an accountant or a lawyer or 100 other things, I wouldn't be as happy as I am today. So in some ways I'm like, you just sort of have to encourage them to pursue what they love, and then understand that at some point they're going to be a responsible adult, and you know, those financial burdens will fall on them, but it's hard to know, right?
Impossible to know. You know, never in a million years, even when I was 25, did I think that this is what I would be doing in my late 30s. It's impossible to know, even when you are in your 20s, what you're going to end up at in the middle of your career, to say nothing of, like, do your parents know what you're going to be and who you're going to be when you're 6 years old, trying to forecast what they're going to be in the future.
Yeah. Well, I'm not sure Morgan and I have anything figured out, but hopefully if you're listening, you're just as confused as we are when we can all hold hands and commiserate on this one. So getting to the end here, Morgan, I really like this question from Adam Eugene too. You're someone who tends to sort of start your writing off with these really awesome anecdotes, these really great stories that are kind of deep cuts, things that I've never heard of before. And Adam Eugene wants to know, how do you filter information, and what are your most commonly used mental models for understanding the world around you?
Well, all the stories just come from a bunch of casual reading that is never forced. It's never intentional. It's not like, oh, I'm setting out to in search of the next anecdote and I think I'll find an anecdote. And it's never like that. It's just, I spend a lot of time reading things that I think are kind of interesting. I almost never read business or investing or economics books. I read a lot of history and science books and just like, I think anything that might be a little bit interesting. And if you do enough of that, always with this little seed in your head of like, oh, how can what I just read teach me something about investing? You see them everywhere. Mm. Once you look for them, they are everywhere. And I think in like, take any book about any subject from any era, any genre, you can find an investing lesson in that book. I'm totally confident in that if you're looking for it, because all investing is just a study of human behavior, and human behavior is everywhere. If you just get a glimpse of like how people think and how the world works and how people make decisions, how they think about greed and fear and risk and uncertainty, those topics and examples of those topics are everywhere. So there's no process, there's no structure. It's just a lot of casual reading with a lens of trying to find it. That's all it is. And in terms of mental models, I think a lot of people get too caught up in trying to force the world into their mental models. It's important to have like broad understandings of how certain models work, but a lot of people get way too hung up on it about like, oh, here's this problem I face in my life. Let's shove that into the compounding model, the incentives model, and try to like find an answer from there. I maybe that works for some people. I never try to force anything in that. I think if you read enough stories, I think maybe that's the difference. Rather than models and like formulas of like, this is how the world works, I just try to think of a lot of just anecdotal stories of how people dealt with things and what their blind spots were and how they justified bad decisions. And if you just have enough of those stories in your head, I think you do start to view the world a little bit differently. So there's really no, I know that's an imperfect answer, but there's no strategy. There's no structure. It's just a lot of casual reading.
Well, you know, any kind of model, right? And it's going to focus you on a certain subset of things, and it's going to make you blind to a different subset of things. So models are imperfect, just like any ways of understanding the world. You know, I'm a big existential philosophy guy. And one of the things that all the existential philosophers talk about is that, you know, happiness can't be pursued, that it ensues from, you know, doing other stuff you enjoy. And, you know, at the beginning, before we hit record, I was like, you know, Morgan, teach me how to sell 2 million books. And, you know, you were saying, look, so much of this is luck. It's an incredibly well-written book, right? That's the 10%. But the 90%, there's a lot of it that's luck. But I think your life and your process is a lesson in pursuing what matters to you, pursuing your passion, doing it with great consistency over time. You've been writing, you know, very regularly for a decade and a half now. So greatness ensues from a life that's spent following your passions and doing it with some regularity, not trying to shoehorn life into some sort of prepackaged mental model.
Yeah, I think that's right. And it's like, maybe like, what is the mental model that you know is going to work? It's just like, you, the best chance that you have of getting what you want is just hard work and patience. It's like the simplest, obvious mental model that's out there is the one that actually works. Everyone is always looking for a hack and a shortcut. And the big takeaway for so many subjects is that there is no hack. There is no shortcut. If you want good health, good exercise, good investing results, it takes hard work and patience and grinding and mental fortitude. There's no hack. There's no easy answer. And so like many years ago, we hired, when at a previous job, they hired a social media consultant who came in and did a presentation for us. And they had all these like social media hacks. And it was literally like, oh, if you want your tweet to get the best engagement, you should publish it at Tuesday at 8:43 AM. That's what gets the best. And I mean, like, but none of what this person talked about was, if you want to do well on social media, you have to write good content. That was never mentioned. They had all these like tricks. And I was sitting there like, no, if you want to do well on social media, write good content. That's the hack. But nobody wants to hear that because it's not a shortcut. Everyone wants the equivalent of like the pill that they can just pop and get the results. And it just doesn't work that way. Maybe like that's the mental model that I have the most faith in.
Yeah. Patience, hard work, dedication, pursuing something you love. Back when I was a real doctor, I would, you know, speak to my patients and I would always start with things, you know, these people come to me with some sort of concern and I would always start with things like diet, rest, exercise, nutrition. Are you spending enough time with your friends? Like, how is work? And people would get frustrated and they're like, where's the pills? Yeah. What say the magic words to me, psychology man, you know, say the words to me, tell me how to think in a way that's not going to make me feel terrible. I talk about this all the time. I had a client come to me with anxiety who was drinking 6 cups of coffee a day. And I'm like, look, until you stop drinking 6 cups of coffee a day, we have nothing to talk about. Like there's nothing you can think or I can say to you. Like, you are simulating a panic attack through your excessive consumption of caffeine. We're going to start there and then we're going to work on it. And people would get huffy, right? Like, everybody wants the shortcut. Maybe the mental model is hard work, dedication, perseverance.
As I finish what is almost certainly my 6th cup of coffee this morning, I will toast to that.
Well, we all know I'm a Diet Coke guy. the most liked of all the questions came from Gretchen Housel, who you may know. And Gretchen Housel asks, when is the new book coming out? And as an addendum to that, Daniel Crosby will ask, what's the new book about?
Well, Gretchen Housel is my wife. And, you know, because when is a new book coming out? It's always a moving target, which is why she asks. I would say this. I think there is a good chance that you'll be able to buy the book in the summer of 2023, next summer. Nice. One year from now. I think that's a very good chance that that's when it'll be out. What is it about? I'll give you the very broad overview. It's about the behaviors that never changed, that never change over time. So what was true about how people behaved 100 years ago that will be true 100 years from now? What are the things we spend so much time, particularly in the finance industry, focusing on what's going to change? What's the next hot industry? Like, where are things like what's going to change in the economy? And I think way more important than that is what never changes. What can we put all of our faith in that will be dictating and controlling the economy 100 years from now? Like, what are those things, the behaviors that never change? That's what the book's about.
Wow. I cannot wait to read it. Morgan, congrats on all your success, my guy. It's wonderful to have you back. We're going to break your previous record with the downloads on this one. Thank you again. If people want to buy the book, follow you online, where can we find your work?
There's a tiny little startup called Amazon.com that you can buy the book at. That's or anywhere else. The book is in lots of different stores. I spend most of my time online on Twitter. My handle is Morgan Housel, first and last name.
Awesome. Let's help that young Jeffrey Bezos out by supporting the book on Amazon. Morgan, thank you again.
Thanks, Daniel.
Thanks for tuning in to Standard Deviations. If you can't wait till next week for more behavioral finance insights, visit www.orion.com. All opinions expressed by Dr. Daniel Crosby and podcast guests are solely their own opinions and do not reflect the opinion of or endorsement by Orion and its affiliates, subsidiaries, and employees. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as a basis for legal, tax, and investment decisions. The opinions are based upon information the participants consider reliable.